On this show, I talked to author Matt Ault about his new book, Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World, and the impact that the accidental success of Japan's soft power has had on the rest of the world. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe, and I'm very excited about today's show because I am speaking with author Matt Ault about his new book titled Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World. And Matt and I, we come from the same era. We're kind of what we would call Gen Xers. We're born in the 70s, grew up in the 80s. And I gotta tell you, growing up in the 80s, I think was one of the most exciting times in recent history to grow up because you had all this cool stuff that was starting to come out. The consumer electronics boom was really kickstarted during that era, but it was before the internet came about. So I honestly think that era was a lot more fun. Even though the internet has brought a lot of amazing things to our society, I feel like the internet has also caused a lot of problems as well. Especially the social media platforms has caused a lot of issues in societal issues and whatnot. And so I feel like the 80s was kind of that kind of the golden age of consumer electronics, so to speak, because you had the fun of being able to play with all these devices without all the hassle of the social media and algorithms and ads and all this kind of stuff that we have today, you know. So it was really fun to read Matt's book because in his book, he talks about how many of these things that we actually take for granted now originated in Japan. And there was a time when they didn't exist. Things like karaoke, the Walkman, emoji, Hello Kitty, anime, all these things originated in Japan. And we kind of take them for granted now. But both Matt and I remember a time when these didn't exist in the Western world. And we both remember a time when this huge kind of wave of Japanese pop culture swept over the West. And I gotta say, it was a really fun and exciting time to be around to see this all these new things that were coming out. So if you're a fan of Japanese pop culture, or you just grew up in the 80s and you kind of want to have a fun nostalgic trip down memory lane, I definitely recommend checking out his book because his book is incredibly detailed. In fact, I was actually surprised how detailed it was and how many topics he was able to cover, because originally I thought it would be kind of something a little bit smaller. But I asked Matt, like, what prompted him to create such an in-depth piece on this aspect of Japan's culture?
I'll tell you, like with most things in my life, it emerged from a kind of dissatisfaction that there wasn't anything out there that satisfied that need for me in English. You know, if the ultimate book like this was already out there, I wouldn't have written it. I would have written something else. But because there was really, like I was saying before, there's a lot of really great books out there about Japanese culture and pop culture, both, you know, but most of them are either deep dives into single genres of stuff, or there's something like, you know, kind of tabloidy, kind of like crime or murder related stuff. And I realized there was no singular book out there that really explained how this tiny country in East Asia came to have this outsized cultural gravity that kind of sucked in the rest of the world. Because most of us, you know, we don't interact with Japan. Even if you're like a Hello Kitty fan, you're probably also interacting with Japan through other things too. Like maybe you have a Walkman, or maybe you play Nintendo, or, you know, it's a multifaceted thing. And I don't think you can explain how Japan came to dominate the global dreamscape without talking about multiple inventions and multiple fantasy delivery devices that brought us here.
Right, yeah. Do you think that this kind of, I guess they call it like soft culture promotion?
Soft power.
Soft power, yeah. Do you think this was planned by Japanese government and these manufacturers, or?
Oh, no way.
Yeah,
no, one of the big takeaways that I learned myself when I was writing the book is how little even the architects and creators of these products understood how they would be used.
Right.
Like, The Walkman's a perfect case in point because Akio Morita, who was the chairman of Sony at the time, this is like a really smart guy who's like made, you know, he's helmed this company for many years, and now he's the chairman of it, and he's overseen the creation of many like key electronic products, you know, transistor radios and miniature TVs. And he and everybody else at Sony thought the only people who would buy the Walkman were kids who were studying late at night and didn't want to disturb their parents. You know, they thought it was, and that's who they marketed it towards at first. And they only made like 30,000 of them because they thought it would be this just kind of, you know, tool that kids would use. And then it ended up becoming this total transformation of the way that we spent time in urban spaces in particular and alone with ourselves. Like it just profoundly transformed that. So, you know, you can't plan soft power. Like it has to happen naturally, gradually, kind of grassroots. It has to happen through all of us making unconscious decisions to use things and embrace new forms of thinking.
Yeah, it's I asked that question because, you know, I've worked in Japan for a number of years, and one of the things I've encountered is the lack of understanding when it comes to marketing for many Japanese companies. So, like, it didn't make sense to me that you have this. That they would have been able to architect this, because I thought there's no way. Like, you guys can't market your own products to your own people in Japan. Yes, there's no way you could have crapped. So it's like, it's basically a giant accident that was very fortunate for Japan, you know. But
I think, you know, Japanese pop culture often succeeds in spite of the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's actually, conversely, I think its charm. It gives it this authenticity because you kind of have to discover
it. Right.
You know, there isn't this like massive hype campaign you get for like the Avengers or something like that, where they're like carefully targeting demographics and really aware of how they're going to sell this thing. And with Japanese products, so often, like there's a cultural barrier, there's a linguistic barrier. And I think the fact that you have to kind of stumble across so many things like anime and manga is precisely why they're so easy to incorporate into our identities.
Right. Yeah. The Walkman story is particularly interesting because, you know, I remember when the Walkman came out, and it's interesting to read in your book how nervous they were about releasing this product, you know. And it's hard to imagine now when you think of like iPods and iPhones and even just the success of the Walkman, if you're old enough to remember that. Like, it just seems like such a no-brainer. But when you look back and you read it in your book, like, Sony was so nervous about this.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, like, no idea if people would buy it or not.
We don't. Another thing I really that I learned in the process of writing the book was that most of the things in the book that I talk about aren't really high tech. They're actually very low tech or cobbled together from like earlier technologies in a new way. They're more like remixes. Right. You know, the perfect example, that's the Game Boy. The first Game Boy was like a terrible machine from specification standpoint. Like, its screen was this like sickly green and had this blur. Yeah, remember that?
Yeah.
And like, you know, and it was it succeeded because the games it served up were so great. You know, it was so easy to use. It was indestructible. Like, you know, it didn't eat batteries like my Atari Lynx did, which, you know, I also had the kind of competitor to it. And it just felt like a lifestyle device, much more so than other portable gaming systems. And that's like a kind of sweet spot, I think, that Japanese creators are really good at hitting. You know, it's just things that really fit into your life in a way that you, when you encounter them, you're like, oh, was there ever a time when I didn't have this? Like, it's easy to forget.
Yeah,
you know?
It's kind of funny now that you mentioned that. I do remember the first Game Boy had that horrible green colored screen.
Oh, man.
That little contrast, and you could adjust the contrast on it, and it's just like,
and no backlight.
Yeah,
it was like. Like, the minute the sun went down, like, you couldn't game anymore. It was like to try explaining that to like a 10 or even a 15-year-old today. It's just like unthinkable.
Yeah, that's too funny. What was the research like for this book? Because you cover a wide range of topics in this book. Were you traveling all up and down Japan to interview these people? Or how did you even get started on the research for this?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, I was helped out in a couple of ways. One is that, like, there's a lot of industry associations out there. So for instance, for the karaoke chapter, I started by going to this, there's this like All Karaoke Industrialists Association, I think is what its name is in English. And they, after I explained what I was doing, they introduced me to Negishi-san, the guy who invented the first karaoke machine, and gave me a ton of materials that they had on like the history of it and, you know, how it was consumed. For other ones, you know, there's a ton of writing in Japan from people who created hit products. Like that's like a whole genre of books out here. So like, you know, Hello Kitty's manager, Sanrio's president, you know, the guy who invented the Tamagotchi, like they all have memoirs. Oh, okay. And if you can read Japanese, these things are just a treasure trove of anecdotes and information that I had never seen in English before. And I think it's just simply the linguistic barrier. So like I would, you know, read these books and then like in the books, they would mention other books. And then, you know, I'd go to the National Diet Library and like look through like, you know, old out of print stuff and magazines and old newspaper articles. I always wanted to kind of see what the Japanese mass media reaction to things was at the time. So like if you go to the National Diet Library here, which is the it's not a food library. it's like the Library of Congress. They have this, you know, you can keyword search basically through old magazine article titles and newspaper titles. And so it would be really interesting to type in karaoke and like restrict the search to, you know, 1975 to 1980 and read about all these like editorials of like this karaoke is destroying Japan, you know, kind of stuff.
And, which is actually, you know, what they thought when it was released, like, right? Like, what is the hikikatari? What is that?
Yeah, so hikikatari are a player. They're basically minstrels. They're like mariachi, you know, like you have in Central America and Mexico and right. places like that. They wander around. They have guitars and you give them some money and they'll play you a song. And whatever song you want. And until the karaoke machine came around, they were like human karaoke. They would, you know, you'd call one over, you'd give him 1,000 yen and he'd play 3 or 4 songs for you and you'd sing along to them. And the karaoke machine basically put them out of business. Totally put them out of business. It's like one of the early examples of automating away a creative field.
And
you
these bands, were they in like a nightclub or in a pub or like a izakaya or?
So I talk about this in the book, but they had these like big nightlife districts in major Japanese cities. And, you know, these guys, the hikikatari, the minstrels would go from bar to bar. And there's this whole kind of ecosystem of the nightlife in Japan, like especially in the 60s and 70s. It's changing now because people don't go out drinking as much after work. But in the 60s and 70s and 80s and even 90s, it was expected that you would go out either with your colleagues or entertain clients after work. And so they would have things like cabarets, which are these would have these shows of like the dancing ladies like kicking their heels in the air with like to a live accompaniment. There would be hostess clubs where you had more intimate one-on-one interaction with ladies. Izakaya are actually places in Japan that you go to eat at. Like there's no kind of entertainment of any kind or anything like that. But there's another level called the snack, which is a sort of bar that is, they do have music there on like a jukebox or something. And those places are where the hikikatari would target. They would go into snacks and say, do you guys want to sing? And, you know, and they would do it that way. So there's a lot of these places don't exist in Western like entertainment right. culture. And that was another kind of revelation of the book is you can't really understand why karaoke was invented unless you understand this system of nightlife in Japan in the 60s and 70s, because that's what created the need right. for it. You know, in the West, like, you know, we didn't really have that culture at all. You know, Mad Men, people are drinking in the office, right? You know? Right? It's like, and they're entertaining clients and stuff, but like at a steakhouse, you know, they don't really go to this, like there aren't levels of entertainment right. in the West,
right.
you know?
Right. And so when the karaoke machine was invented, it's interesting in your book, actually, you talk about how it's kind of invented by two different guys kind of at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was independently invented five yeah. times, like in between the years of 1967 and 1973, I think. And that just goes to show you that it was independently invented five times in Japan and not once in America or England or Europe. It just goes to show you why the Japanese cultural background is so important for understanding how that machine came to be.
Yeah, definitely. And then maybe talk a bit about like what was the backlash when this machine was invented, because you talk a bit about in your book about these musicians who played this hikikatari, who saw this, karaoke machine as a threat.
Well, they did. It was a threat. Like, they were right to see it as a threat. And so they were like among the most vocal critics of it because it was affecting their livelihood. But then more interestingly, you know, as karaoke proliferated through the cities of Japan, you got all these problems like noise complaints because people are like singing loud late into the night. You have these issues, people like the karaoke rage where people are fighting over the mic. You know, you get drunk and like it starts like a fist fight or somebody who's like disses you for the way you're singing. But the most interesting one was this like really kind of impassioned op-ed piece that I found about how like we're losing the art of bar conversation because people stopped going to bars to interact with each other. They just kind of basically waited for their own turn to sing. And then like somebody's singing and then you're not really able to talk to each other anymore. So that kind of, you know, transformation of the way that we interacted with each other is kind of key to the whole karaoke experience, and one that most karaoke histories I've read in English don't really deal with. And I really wanted to kind of explore that.
And then the karaoke, it's interesting in your book, you mentioned that, what was it, like at the peak in the 90s, like almost half the population of Japan had visited karaoke, like 60 million people. But karaoke in Japan was quite different than how it was done in America, wasn't it?
Yeah. Like, well, because it's a very individual type thing here. They have these, starting from the 80s, you had karaoke boxes, which are basically individual rooms where like small groups would gather and kind of and do it themselves. Where in the West, it was always kind of a spectator sport. There'd be a karaoke machine in a bar and you'd go up there and sing like, you know, Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up or whatever. And you crack people up or, you know, Queen, you know, that kind of stuff. And it was much more about a performance. Whereas in Japan, it was much more about connecting and unwinding. And that's why when a digital streaming karaoke emerged in the 90s, and was adopted by schoolgirls in particular, it like profoundly transformed the Japanese music industry because suddenly pop stars were writing songs specifically for karaoke that were easy to sing for the average person. And you kind of lost the divas, you lost the technicians, you lost the, you know, the people. In the past, we turned to people who had voices unlike ours. Because, wow, what a voice, what a pair of lungs on that person. That's an amazing instrument they have. But in Japan, and starting in the 90s, pop music came to be all about, well, can I sing this myself? If an average person couldn't sing it, it was just not produced. And so you got this kind of sameness of musical culture. And it's the same kind of thing that we see all over the world today in algorithm-driven content delivery, you know, where you're given things, you clicked on something and then YouTube or whatever suggests something similar. And so you just start consuming nothing but that. Karaoke was kind of the original algorithm, even though there wasn't an algorithm. It was just simply people making their choices on streaming karaoke and the companies watching and seeing what was sung. It was kind of a human algorithm from that standpoint.
But I never realized that.
Yeah. And so it's the progenitor. You know, people think of karaoke as being, oh, karaoke, I hate singing, blah, blah, blah. But it's actually the progenitor of all sorts of very current modern issues that we're wrestling with today, from like user generated content. It's basically the first user generated content out there, like user remixes and things like that, because you're basically singing your own way over an existing song. And also in that whole it was the first streaming music service in like 1991 or two, I'm pretty sure. And that allowed people to play Moneyball with the music industry and basically tweak songs so that you would always hit, because it was always something very palatable and it was not challenging. So, and we're seeing that today with all sorts of content, you know, ranging from not only music, but things like conspiracy theories, that when you click on one and then algorithms keep serving you up more. And in a very real way, karaoke is kind of the origin of
that. It's interesting that you you mentioned that initially, because we think of karaoke, like you mentioned, like a lot of young people, you know, would use it and enjoy it. But it's funny that you mentioned that in the beginning, it wasn't quite like that. The music that they initially sung in the beginning was that Enka music.
Which is old people. Young people actually rejected it. Didn't want to hear
their old boss singing this old ass song. Yeah, like so.
No. Until like 1985, like karaoke would strike terror into the hearts of young people because that meant like that their grandpa or their boss or their dad was like dragging them out to like sing old songs and you know. And it wasn't like a case like, you know, oh, your dad wants to go out and sing the Beatles. Well, you know, like everybody loves the Beatles. You know what I mean? Even if you're not like a fan, like, you know, you can get behind that. But like, Enka was not pop music as young people were listening to at all. So it was just like a very sort of like different world.
It's funny that you mentioned that it was Bruce Springsteen who actually pushed the youth into karaoke with his song Born in the USA.
I really wanted to talk to him because I'm sure he wasn't involved in that at all. Like, you know, did you know that you single-handedly transformed the demographic of karaoke from, you know, old people to young people? You know, when because for people who haven't read the book yet, Born in the USA was the first rock album translated into karaoke in its entirety. And that was like a big deal in the early 80s when that happened. It really helped flip the demographic of karaoke.
You know, one of the things I found kind of interesting in the early chapters of your book is that you know, it seems like as much as Japan has exported the soft power to the outside world, there's still quite a big fascination from within Japan towards things from the outside world as well. Sure. Like in the early stories of your book with Matsuzo
Kosuke.
How do you say this guy's name?
Kosuke-san. Yeah.
And he was a toy manufacturer, and his first toy after the war was modeled after an American Jeep, because that's what everyone saw driving around Japan. And I was surprised at that, because I would have thought, like, why would these kids want to play with a toy of a country that's supposedly, taking over Japan. You know what I mean? The kind of an oppressor country at the time. But they were fascinated with this toy Jeep.
Well, I think, to the credit of the occupation forces, I mean, and this isn't to say that it was an easy road or anything, but they were really ordered not to basically torment the Japanese, and especially kids, like, were treated really pretty well by American servicemen, from what I understand. So you had these, you know, crowds of Japanese kids, little kids, running after Jeeps because they'd be giving them gum and chocolate and like Coke and, you know, these kind of things from America, because, you know, nobody held it against the kids. I don't think in those immediate post-war years. So there was this kind of, the Americans were larger than life to kids at the era. And I think that's a big reason why Kosuge's Jeep hit so big, because it was like they were kind of heroes to the little kids. The little kids didn't fight in the war. You know, they suffered greatly. But, you know, when you're like 5 years old, it's a lot more difficult to make the connection between, you know, the B-29s that burned down your neighborhood when you were even younger than that, and these, like, you know, these big strapping American guys who are giving you bars of chocolate on the street.
Right, right.
So, but, you know, I think most of the best Japanese products are created in a dialogue with the outside world. You know, Kosuge and the American Jeep, or like karaoke and the Walkman, they're based on Western American and European tape decks. Anime is hugely, the first anime series was hugely inspired by Disney style. Osamu Tezuka, the creator of Astro Boys, just a huge, massive Walt Disney fan. And you see this over and over again in the book, that the things that the Japanese creators made aren't necessarily their parts aren't necessarily new. What is new and novel is the way they've combined them into these new things that nobody had anticipated and that fit kind of new needs for us.
Right.
That remixing. So, like, you know, the more of a dialogue there is, I think, the more powerful the product gets.
Right. Yeah. I found that the early story of Kosuge-san very interesting. And that how he measured the Jeep with his bath towel.
He had nothing, right?
Yeah, like literally nothing. And then from nothing, and using like spent U.S. military surplus to make the molds and whatnot.
Literal junk. The Jeeps are made out of junk, like scrap tin that he scavenged from their dumps and things like that. So, you know, that's actually a really powerful moment. Like Kosuke was one of Japan's top toy makers before the war, and the toy industry was a huge export industry for Japan in the years leading up to World War II. They were like poised to become the number one exporter of toys around the world, and to be toppled from that to where Kosuge is like scrambling around in a scrap heap is kind of a powerful symbol for what happened to Japan after World War II. And so too is how Kosuge just kind of rolled with that and actually made something out of it.
And actually used the scrap from the war, empty canisters and empty food cans that the Americans had thrown away, used that to rebuild his business.
Yes.
It's pretty telling.
And not only his business, but the entire, like, toys were one of only two products cleared for export in like 1946. So he really, in a very real way, helped rebuild the Japanese economy. Like,
Just with the toys. I was really surprised to read that, actually, because I didn't know anything about that. But to read that the Japanese toy industry rebounded after the war and became so big and actually really helped rebuild the Japanese economy was fascinating to read.
Well, and now it's like all we think about, right? When most people think about Japan, all they think about are toys. Like if you include games in that, like Pokemon, you know, or, you know, the Transformers or what have you, like toys became, you know, they've basically gone back to their roots in a certain way, you know?
Yeah. It's really interesting to kind of read these origin stories in your book because, you know, I think a lot of these, especially nowadays, these origin stories are not known as much. Like if you didn't grow up in the 80s, you wouldn't have known a time before Hello Kitty or before Walkman or before these things, right? So to read like these origin stories of how these things got started was absolutely fascinating. And I mean, like even Hello Kitty, I didn't know this was like kind of an afterthought, right? They just stuck the cat on a coin purse,
right? And the guy, I love how like Tsuji-san, who's the president of Sanrio at the time and the founder, is just like he was just whatever, you know. When he saw it, nobody realized it was going to be this magical thing, you know, that Hello Kitty was going to literally redefine femininity, you know, around the world, like, or become a symbol for like kind of girl power around the world. They just thought it was yet another design they were putting on a purse and that was going to be it. And they still don't know why Hello Kitty is as powerful as she is. It's amazing. And they're very upfront about that. The Sanrio people are like, you know, whether you talk to Tsuji or whether you talk to, you know, Yamaguchi, who's her current manager, they're like, she's a symbol of friendship. She's a symbol of love, you know, but if you can't quantify her, you know what I mean? And so that's another really interesting thing. Like, it's just how these things that talented people created slipped through their fingers to become something entirely different as we consumed them, you know? So we're actually, all of us consumers, people who use the Walkman, people who bought Hello Kitty stationery, people who watch the Transformers on TV, people who are anime fans, we're actually all characters in this book because it's our consumption patterns. It's our, you know, incorporating of them into our lives that is what created the world that we live in today.
It is kind of interesting that you know, Japan has had these like home runs, accidental home runs, kind of year after year, isn't it?
Yeah, like, I mean, not so much recently with products. I mean, you know, what you see much more often now are collaborations taking off. Like Pokemon Go is the biggest one of recent years. I mean, Pokemon Go is this, you know, it's an augmented reality game made in Silicon Valley. But it was the Japanese characters that exploded it in popularity, you know, kicked it into the stratosphere. I mean, it's been downloaded billions of times around the world. Yeah, that's amazing. And I think you're going to start seeing now, like, not so much made in Japan, but made everywhere else with Japanese values that we subconsciously have inside of us because we grew up on them.
Yeah. It's actually interesting, like you said, like we grew up on it, but the Japan is it, like, you know, one thing that kind of struck me when reading your book is like a lot of these products that pop culture products that Japan has exported have kind of like a childlike theme to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're purchased by adults.
Yeah. I mean, and that goes Japanese, you know, outside observers are always talking about, oh, Japan is this regimented hierarchical society. You know, back in the 80s during Japan bashing, oh, salarymen, you know, Japanese people are all drones, like slaves to their country and their companies. But, you know, in reality, there's always been this like sense of play running like a deep vein of appreciation for toys and play and amusements running through Japanese society. Like even back in the 1800s, I quote these like early observers who come like, you know, ambassadors and like educators. And we're talking like 1860s. This is like, you know, Abraham Lincoln era. And they're visiting Japan and they're like, wow, like adults are like flying kites and spinning tops. Like nobody in the West would be caught dead doing this after they were about 10 years old.
Right.
What's but yet they've built this crazy society. Like what's going on? And like that sense of play is something that is like so missing from a lot of writing about Japan, whether it's about their economic rise, whether it's about their economic fall. You know, that sense of play is always there. And it's the Walkman's a very playful thing. You know, oh, let's take a tape deck and make it tiny so you can carry it around with you. Like now it's like, you know, obvious. But back then it wasn't, you know, and those kind of playful approaches to technology and entertainment products and things like that are what differentiate, I think, Japanese the things in this book in particular as fantasy delivery devices from other products abroad.
Yeah, there's something magical about it, isn't it? Like these products, like it's just like, I think Apple has really kind of tried their best to, it's like maybe one of the few companies that really tried their best to kind of create these products that just, that fit into your life without any kind of thought or anything like that. It's just like you have this product one day and then you think like, why didn't I have this product before?
Exactly.
And I think that a lot of products that you mentioned in your book are kind of like that, aren't they? They're just like,
sure.
They just seemed like kind of a natural product.
Yes.
That why didn't this exist before? So there was no real need for a huge marketing campaign or anything like that. They
yeah.
just had to get it in the hands of people and then it would sell itself.
Well, anybody could have invented a lot of these things, you know what I mean? But they didn't. Japanese did. Or maybe they did. And like there was actually a Brazilian man, I believe, who invented a precursor of the Walkman. But, you know, he didn't have the ability to really market it or sell it. So it just remained a kind of, you know, this kind of tinkerer's contraption that was limited to, you know, he was a genius coming up with it. But it was this combination not only of being able to create things, but also so send them all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, Sony had a huge distribution network. And then as those things started to hit other countries, you get scenes like, you know, I write about this in the book. Steve Jobs gets one and doesn't even listen to it. He just takes it apart because he's just like, wow, how did he make this? And you would not have the iPod without the Walkman.
You just wouldn't,
you know, and without the iPod, you wouldn't have the smartphone.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there's a whole other story about why didn't Sony create those things? Because Sony had its own record label and its own like mobile phone division and everything else. But, you know, they didn't. The baton was passed there from Japan back to America.
Yeah.
So,
you know who I would love to talk to is the guy who invented the sports Sony Walkman.
Oh, yeah.
The yellow one.
I
love
that
those?
One. Yes.
Because to me, like the first Walkman was pretty amazing, of course, but it was very utilitarian looking. And I think the sports Walkman that came out in the 80s with the yellow covering on it really pushed the Walkman into the stratosphere. Because because in the 80s was when a really huge fitness craze came over America. You had Arnold and Sylvester Stallone on screen everywhere. Everyone went from, you know, the 70s was a bit of a different era.
And then suddenly everyone
wanted to be super buff and super fit. And then you had this like bright yellow device you could strap to your waist so that everybody knows you're super fit.
Because it's a signaling device, right? It's like a status symbol too. And that's something that's carried on with modern electronic devices. The Walkman was the first piece of technology that was also a status symbol.
Yeah.
And
you wrote in your book, so who is it? Someone actually wore a Walkman to like an awards show?
No, well, I mean, Paul Simon was wearing his on stage during, you know, Graceland, like when he got his Grammy. And like, you know, Andy Warhol is walking all over New York City just wearing the headphones. He's not even got it plugged in because the headphones are the signifier. They're the status symbol. So and that's just one of the cultures that the Walkman created. I mean, the aerobics craze you were talking about is directly tied into the Walkman. It's kind of like going out and going jogging with your listening to music. That was physically not possible before 1980 when the Walkman came to America. Like you could do it. Like you could carry a boombox on your shoulder, I guess, but that was more for like break dancers, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's interesting because until the Walkman came out, literally the boombox was the epitome of portable sound technology, but it was a shared experience. You know, you would blast it. Whereas the Walkman was entirely an internal experience. And as the book goes on, you see these experiences that Japan is making become more and more personalized. They become less, they connect us together, but they also isolate us at the same time. Everybody had a Walkman, but when you're listening to your Walkman, you can't really interact with anybody else. You know, and it's the same thing with kind of social media today, which was arguably invented on the streets of Japan by schoolgirls who invented texting, who were the first mobile internet users, who first started using emoji and things like that. And the Japanese teenagers who started using anonymous, like 2-channel, the anonymous image boards there. They connect us together, but they also kind of isolate us in the same way. We don't see each other. You know, right. we don't touch each other. We don't, you know, we can only kind of shout at each other, you know, indirectly. And all of that stuff that we are still wrestling with today in society about how technologies connect and isolate us at the same time are questions that were first asked in Japan.
Do you have any thoughts about what might be the next big Japanese soft power export?
Yeah, I get asked this a lot, but, you know, truly, I don't think. And I'm not saying Japanese inventors aren't going to make something cool. I mean, they probably will. But I think you're going to see we're so interconnected these days. You're going to see less made in Japan and more made outside Japan with Japanese values. You know, Pokemon Go is a great example of that. Westerners who are starting to draw like in an anime or manga style. I mean, Hollywood has been, you know, hugely inflected by that. If you turn on the Cartoon Network, there's all of these, you know, Marvel Comics based cartoon shows on, but they're drawn in a very visibly anime style, you know, or Avatar the Last Airbender. You know, this is Westerners making stuff with Japanese kind of aesthetic values. And, you know, I think you're going to start seeing much more of that and remixed in even more interesting ways in the years to come.
Thanks again to Matt for coming on the show. If you want to check out his book, you can do so at any bookstore, or you can find it on Amazon or any website online that you would buy your books from. You can also buy it from his website at mattalt.com. And like I said, like if you grew up in the 70s and 80s and you're a fan of Japanese pop culture, or even if you didn't even grow up in that era, you kind of want to, you know, go back in time and find out where all this stuff started. I really recommend this book because he has done a tremendous amount of research into the origin stories of some of these things that we kind of take for granted today. Like think about the Walkman. Like, you know, like we have iPods. Like in the book, he actually talks about like a whole section about the headphones and how Sony was worried about people walking around with headphones, how weird that would be and what size should the headphones be and all this. And it's funny to think about that now, because now no one ever thinks about walking around with headphones at all, right? It's just such a common thing. But there was a point in time when the executives at Sony were like, are people gonna walk around with these weird things on their head, you know? And so it's a really, really fascinating look at how all these things got started, the impact that they had both in Japan and in North America. And so I highly recommend the book to anyone who's interested in Japanese pop culture. I'm probably going to give it actually another read and maybe even a third one as well, because I love these kind of origin stories of how things get invented and how they get started and all that. Like, I love when I read about like how the iPod got started or how the Walkman got started or all these kind of origin stories. So it's been an absolutely fascinating read for me, but definitely recommend checking it out. And that's it. That wraps up this episode of the Tokyo Podcast. I want to thank everybody for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
after many years of working at various jobs, my wife and I founded what's called a localization company. We translate Japanese video games and manga and things like that. The company is called Alt Japan, and we founded it in 2003 in Tokyo.
Ah, okay. I see on your website, you're a smart man. You made your wife the president of your company, you the vice president.
That wasn't even a question.